Well, on the 14th of August 1917, the middle class, mostly middle class readership of the Sydney Morning Herald were treated to the following passage by written by one W.D. Carmalt, the manager of the refreshment rooms at Central Station. He was describing the scandalous behaviour of the young women he employed as waitresses. For the past few days, the girls have been rather out of hand. They were inclined to laugh and jeer at those over them, and discipline was being seriously affected. Acting under instructions, I called them all together this morning. I explained to them that they were there in the public interest to serve anyone who should come along. I just explained a few of them who refused to serve some scabs. I then asked those who were willing to abide by that course to stand aside to one side, and those that were prepared to leave to do so. Thereupon, they all put on their hats and coats and marched off. Amidst laughter and cheers. Now, that's a small anecdote of a very small group of strikers who took part in what was the biggest strike in Australian history. 100,000 workers in all states, but predominantly in the East Coast, predominantly in New South Wales and to a lesser extent Victoria, who were on strike for varying periods, but on average about 5 weeks in the middle of a world war. And it's interesting to I state that basic fact because many of you would have studied perhaps Australian history at high school, and if your experience was like mine, you wouldn't have heard of that strike. You probably would have heard of the conscription referendums. You know about the split in the ALP and Billy Hughes, but this enormous strike is usually left out. And even if you went to university and you studied Australian history at university and you're told about the conscription referendum, you might know a bit more about the radicalisation that accompanied that political crisis. You might know about the IWW, which grew in that period. But there's very little mention of this strike. And what there is little, more generally, there's little mention of the economic crisis, which in my opinion was even as least equally which accompanied the war was just as important as the war itself, or for that matter, the uprising in Ireland, in generating the radicalisation within the working class. Just to give you one basic fact, which I think illustrates it. Between 1914 and 1919, the cost of living in Australia rose 66%. Waterside workers had received their first award from Justice Higgins in 1914. They received no wage rise until August 1919. So they had a 66% decline in the purchasing power of their wages. And when they got that second rise, it was 28%. That gives you some idea of what was happening to workers in Australia during the First World War. Not only were their sons and their husbands being slaughtered on the fields of France, but they were going hungry. And the response was a strike wave, which began in late 1915 and early 1916 with a strike at Broken Hill, which became led to a massive strike wave in 1916, which culminated in the coal strike at the end of that year, and which continued through 1917. And that's where we come to the strike that I'm talking about now. It's important to understand that context of what happened. Because if you just look at the genesis of the mass strike of 1917, and you look at what happened, which is a group of workers in a workplace in Sydney had their conditions attacked and they went on strike. Doesn't sound that unusual. Why did it lead to this mass strike? Well, part of it, the central part, is to understand that political context. The other thing to understand, just briefly, about the cause of the strike, it happened in the Randwick and Everleigh workshops of the railways, New South Wales railways. They were the biggest workplace in Australia at the time. They had about, together, the two workshops had around 7,000 workers. And the railways, New South Wales railways, which was in debt because of the war, decided to attack its work, the conditions of the workers by introducing a form of Taylorism, a form of scientific management with stopwatches and all the rest of it, which was a direct attack on their conditions. Not surprisingly, the workers didn't want to accept that, and they decided by themselves Their first meeting was Matt Vic Hall was rented by the union officials, but no officials were interested in attending. But they went to the delegates all went, called a mass meeting, and they voted to go and strike. Okay, a simple start. But what happened was an explosion of solidarity. And I'll just give you a brief narrative of how, so you get a feel for the mechanics of it, but also then later I'll talk about the spirit that was involved, which some of which was embodied in that anecdote I started with. The mechanics were simple. There were a group of workers. Most of the workers in the workshops were skilled workers, but there was one group of labourers whose job was to fuel the trains when they came through. And they were replaced straight away by clerks, management people, because that job was, you couldn't run the railways without it. Immediately, the engine drivers, the union, responded. Not the union officials, who were incredibly right-wing, but the militants who dominated the Sydney branch of a union decided to go on strike because they were not going to drive trains that had been fueled by scabs. The next thing that happened was that there was a lot of pressure within some sections of the railways union, particularly in Sydney, for a railway strike. And the one occasion in this whole strike where union officials decided to call their members out before they got on strike, there's a few occasions where they ex facto endorsed the strike, but this was the one occasion where they did so. The railways workers throughout New South Wales were called out. And it's interesting that this is the one case where adherence of strike was not universal, about a third scabbed, which I'll come back to later. Okay. The next thing was the coal miners went on strike. Why? Well, in some cases, because actually some of them went on strike before the railway workers, but they knew the railway workers were probably going to go on strike, and they were worried that if they went to work by train, that they might have to go back on a train that was driven by a scab. So they decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go on strike. And there were various other reasons, but basically the coal mines throughout New South Wales stopped. And once coal was taken out of the equation, it was all on the young and old, because this is a coal, still a steam-driven economy. The next step were the waterside workers. They were worried that coal might come across the docks. So even though there wasn't any deliveries of coal, they thought, well, we're going to go on strike anyway. And just as an indication of the spirit of the meetings, in some of these meetings, it's lovely, and I don't have time to give you the long description from the papers, but they talked about how militants, young militants, made use of a handy piano in the corner of the mass meeting to play ragtime songs every time someone spoke against a strike. Okay, so the waterside workers went out, then it spread to the seamen, because the seamen were worried that, oh, okay, now the water fees are out, we don't want to have scabs unloading our ships, we'd have to work with scabs, and that's possible. Now, what happened was then all the ship owners said, okay, we won't do anything in Sydney. But then they decided, oh, we'll go on strike anyway. And the way it happened was that about 200 of the more militant members of the Seamen's Union marched to Trades Hall, found their secretary, who was extremely right-wing, sitting in his office, kidnapped him, took him to their union hall, made him sit and witness a meeting which voted to go on strike. He told them all it was unconstitutional, but they ignored him, sent a delegate down to the docks, and this actually described in a court case, because they got arrested later, who went down and said, strike all out, and then all the ships stopped. Very, to give you some idea of how easy it was to get people to join the strike. It spread then to the carters and drivers who delivered stuff, goods from the waterfront. Then it spread because they didn't want to deal with scabs. Then it spread because they were replaced by scabs. Then it spread to the factories they delivered things to sugar factories, and so on. It spread to Melbourne and Sydney. The seamen in Brisbane went out. The waterside in Melbourne, who were already in dispute over another question, decided to join the strike. And once they were out, the seamen in Melbourne, despite the fact that they'd voted against going on strike in a mass meeting, then each individual ship worked out the minute the scabs arrived. And it spread to factories in Melbourne too, CSR, Dunlop, and so on. And to the timber yards, John Curtin's old union. So that's a basic description of a way the initial spread of this mass strike. And you get some idea of how explosive it was. I'm just going to talk briefly about the government response to this, because as you can imagine, in time of war, The press was not very sympathetic to strikers, to say the least, and the government certainly wasn't. There was thunderous calls for, you know, all sorts of repression and so on, and there was, most importantly, the organisation of mass scabbing. There was a call for volunteers from the middle class, public schools, en masse, sent their senior boys down to have a jolly good time pretending to be wharfies or train drivers or whatever. Actually, they didn't try and drive trains, which was probably a good thing. But some of them tried to work at the coal mines, and that was apparently a cause of great mirth. There was also a large number of volunteers coming in from the rural areas who, having a few more motor skills and so on, were a bit more of a concern for the union movement. And they were housed initially in the SEG and then later in the Taronga Zoo. probably appropriate. And they were used mostly on the waterfront where there wasn't, where, you know, unskilled labour could actually make a difference. Also as carters and drivers, because, you know, some of them were cocky sons and knew how to drive handle a horse. And also when some meat workers went out, a lot of them worked there because they knew how to kill animals being from the bush. The other thing response from the government was on the 21st of August, they arrested three of the trade union officials who tried desperately to stop the strike, the conspiracy to start it. These were included Willis, the head of Coal Miners Union, Claude Thompson, the head of the Railways Union, and Joe Kavanagh, the poor, hapless, extremely right-wing secretary of the Trades and Labour Council, who'd been doing his damnedest to stop the strike from the beginning. They're all arrested for conspiracy. Now, this was important because it gave an excuse for the next two big battalions to move in, two very strategically important battalions. One was the Wonthaggi Miners in Melbourne, because, of course, their union leader had been arrested. That's important because 30% of the coal for Victoria's railways came from Wonthaggi. The other important thing was that because the Coal Miners Union and the Underground Miners Union in Broken Hill had just formally merged, this was an excuse for Broken Hill miners to join the fray. And I'll just say something briefly about Broken Hill miners in World War One, were the most advanced, most militant, most politically developed section of the working class in Australia. They were led... their trade union officials were not like any other trade union official you're likely to see before or since in Australian history. They were revolutionary militants, syndicalists. And they joined the strike willingly. Now, they could have made a difference on paper because one very important thing about Broken Hill during the First World War was Broken Hill mined, amongst other things, lead. The lead was sent to Port Pirie to be smelted. And that lead was 80% of the lead that was used by the Allied forces on the Western Front. No, a decent sort of strategic position to be in, which is why they'd won the first strike back in 1916. But the government had learned a lesson and made sure there were massive stockpiles of unsmelted ore in Port Pirie, because the Port Pirie smelters, the workers there were much more conservative and patriotic, and they were confident that they wouldn't go on strike. So the first thing that the Broken Hill miners did, well, they had a nice ride, but I won't get into that now, but they sent delegations down to Port Pirie to try and win over the smelters. And they actually went close. There was at least one mass meeting which voted to go on strike, but the unions in the smelter organised secret ballots, which they say voted overwhelmingly not to strike, and that kept the lid on things, especially once the government intervened and arrested the delegates from Broken Hill. However, the crisis wasn't over for the government in Port Pirie, because the Wharfies, the branch of the Wharfies union there, was mostly made up of ex-miners from Broken Hill, and they did respond immediately. When a shipment of coal came, and they needed coal to keep the smelter going, and they only had 11 days left, the Wharfies refused to unload it. This led to a furious reaction, and in fact, I got to look at the private notes of Billy Hughes from the cabinet meetings. The only time he mentions a strike is to talk about Port Pirie, and it's just a brief note. It just says, strike at Port Pirie. Trouble with lead, measures taken. Some of those measures were, as I said, the arrest of the delegates from Broken Hill. It also was declaring the whole area a military zone, arranging for the coal to be sent to Port Augusta, where it was unloaded and then moved by train into Port Pirie. But they didn't have proper facilities at Port Augusta, so they went within a bee's whatever of running out of coal and stopping the Western Front. One of the things that helped the government was the attitude of the federal leadership of the Waterside Workers Federation, who threatened to expel their members if they didn't go back to work. Okay. The other thing that became apparent as we're now moving into the late months of August and the early months of September, I want to talk about a bit, was what was happening on the streets of Melbourne and Sydney. Because this was not a passive bureaucratic strike. It was driven from below. And the energy and enthusiasm on the streets was astonishing. In Melbourne, for instance, there was a series of demonstrations. At one stage, there was an official meeting called at the Arrow Bank, which was hijacked by revolutionaries led by Adela Pankhurst, who was a member of the Victorian Socialist Party. And they led what eventually became a crowd of 20,000 people try and march on federal parliament. And while they were doing that, a question was asked in parliament by one of the MPs, does the government know that Jim Larkin, the notorious Irish trade union leader, is on the way from America? And will they do something to stop him from landing? Because they said this as these crowds was being led by one mad Pankhurst woman were charging up the steps, and they got this vision of an even more dangerous agitator arriving at the same time. But that pales into insignificance in comparison to what was happening on the streets of Sydney. Every day, there were tens of thousands on the streets of Sydney. On each Sunday, the crowds got up to initially 100,000, then 150,000, then probably around about 200,000. These were not passive crowds. They sang Solidarity Forever. Okay, sounds like, oh, it's a trade union thing, you sing that. That song was brand new and it was a wobbly song. The wobblies had just been crushed. So it gives you some idea of the mood. And I've just got one quote here about the demonstration from The Sun, which was an afternoon newspaper. Never in the domain has there been such a large number of women at a Labor demonstration. They were there in tens during the conscription campaign, in hundreds during the political rallies when the Nationalists carried the polls. Yesterday they were present in their thousands and tens of thousands, and they had come many weary miles. Some had tramped all the way from Cook River and brought their children with them. So this was a strike in the last weeks of August. There were some extra additions to the ranks of the strikers in the first week of September, including significantly the gas workers in Sydney, who had been waiting till someone tried to deliver coal to them. And this was finally, they got a delivery coal, said, okay, we're off now. So you can imagine the response of the workers when they woke on Sunday, the 10th of September, to discover that the Trades and Labour Council, the Defence Committee that was supposedly running the strike, headed by poor old Joe Kavanagh, who's supposedly, you know, the bloke who's been charged with conspiracy, had just capitulated, had signed a deal to end the strike. The response was instant. A crowd appeared outside the Trades and Labour Council. A worker tried to write in chalk a notice that let's have a mass meeting tomorrow in the Domain. Someone in the crowd said, why not hold it now? Immediately a procession formed, banners were held up, and a crowd of several thousand marched to the Domain and voted unanimously to carry on striking. There was a series of mass meetings. Every single mass meeting rejected the deal. But the officials refused to abide by those votes, where the votes were taken. In one case, in the case of the Metalworkers Union, ASE as it was then called, they refused to hold a vote. They told the press, oh, I didn't hold a vote because I think three quarters would have voted against the deal, so I decided not to. And then next day he said told the same paper, oh, well, we're going ahead because we've had a meeting and it decided to do it. So he contradicted himself. But the officials carried on. And this was enough because there were weaknesses with the strike. The weaknesses were, first of all, the fact that a third of the railway service had not struck, particularly in the rural areas. So there was a skeleton service keeping the railways running. Secondly, there was massive stockpiles of coal that the Railways Commission had set up before the strike, because they had some idea that there was going to be trouble. Thirdly, there was mass scabbing, the volunteers, particularly on the waterfront. This was a big problem. And this This was a problem that hadn't been admitted by the officials before the 9th of September. All the Labour press was full of, everything's going wonderful, but after the 9th of September, we were going to be defeated. We had to stop it. We had to stop the strike. The strike didn't end. First, it took 2 weeks to get the recalcitrant railway unionists and various others back to work. What happened was that even though they voted again and again not to go back, there was a trickle back as the more conservative elements, they had the endorsement of their officials. It wasn't considered scabbing to go back. So the strike gradually collapsed. And eventually, after about a couple of weeks, the railways and most of the other strikers were back. The exceptions were those who couldn't go back because they're effectively facing a form of lockout. That was the waterside workers who'd been replaced by scabs. And in their case, there were enough scabs that were working class and were going to want to stay there that it was a problem for them. The seamen stayed out, despite their right-wing officials, in solidarity with the wharfies. And the coal miners stayed out because two of the coal mines in New South Wales had been filled with scabs from Victoria.
Okay.
So the strike, those strikes petered. It went on for a little while. How long have I got? How many going?
He's got 20 now.
Okay. And they were, not surprisingly, eventually defeated, given the situation. But I want to now talk about what has been, to the extent that anything has been said about this strike by historians, and particularly by left-wing historians, what they've said and what the orthodoxy is. Because generally, if you read the books by Ian Turner, is one of them, or the original book by Vere Gordon Child in 1924, a book called How Labour Governments, an excellent book by a Marxist. But it says, that basically, the line is that this strike was a schmozzle. The silly workers went on strike, didn't know what they were doing. There was too much coal. They were bound to be defeated. Basically, my argument is that that's a load of rubbish for a number of reasons. First of all, I've already talked about Port Pirie. One of the things I've discovered is that Victoria went very, very close to running out of coal. The Victorian Railways made a decision early on, and they actually admitted it afterwards in a internal memo, that they couldn't use any of the coal from New South Wales produced by scabs or from their stockpiles, because if they did, the Victorian Railways would walk out. So they used their own reserves, and they went very close to running out. And the interesting thing there is that, as I said, one faggy went out on the 21st of August, 3 weeks after the start of the strike. The coal, even though they were going out because their trade union official had been arrested, an arrested trade union official tried to stop them. And then on the 9th of September, when the deal was done, they were instructed to go back to work. If they'd gone out from the beginning, and particularly if they'd stayed out with the New South Wales comrades, then Victoria would have run out of coal. So the whole argument about coal stocks is a furphy. The second thing is the tactics of the union officials. They didn't attempt to do anything about scabbing. They had token pickets on the railway workshops, but nowhere else. There was no mass picketing on the docks, for instance. In one of the mines where there was, first mines where there was scabs, their scabs actually had to walk through the pit village on the way to the mine. Mm-hmm. They weren't touched. And the miners were praised by their officials for their restraint. So this is the problem. This is one of the central strategic problems. There wasn't anything. I've never Broken Hill miners, they would have destroyed them. But they didn't use scabs at Broken Hill because they didn't need to. Okay. The other, more important argument has to do with the consequences of the strike. As I said, it was a major defeat. There were mass scabbing on the waterfront. There were scabs completely. Two of the biggest pits on the in the Hunter Valley were completely staffed by scabs. Yet, within a year, because this strike peters out in November 1917, a little more than a year, you have 1919. 1919 sees the biggest wave of strikes in Australian history. And led overwhelmingly by groups of workers who'd been involved in the defeat of 1917. That makes it a very interesting sort of defeat. How did that happen? I just want to briefly talk about it. One of the biggest strikes in 1919 is, I think, an important indicator, and that was the seamen strike. The seamen had been hard done by arbitration, and in January 1919, Higgins gave them an 11% wage rise, which, as you know from what I said before, about the 66% drop in wages, was piddling. They're already angry at their officials for the sellout at the end of 1917. As a consequence, they elected a communist. Well, there wasn't the Communist Party yet, but it was someone who was going to be one of the founders of the Communist Party, a man named Tom Walsh, to be their new, and a team of similar-minded people to be their new officials. The immediate consequence was a mass strike, which smashed arbitration into little bits of tinder about that small. They massively... the coal miners, within a few months of the end of 1917, drove the scabs out of the mines. It's not very difficult in the dark. Down a mine. By 1919, they were in such a strong position that they won a massive wage rise simply by threatening to go on strike. Even the wharfies drove the scabs out of Fremantle. Well, I haven't gone into Fremantle. There was a strike on at the same time, but the government used the same tactics to break it. They drove the scabs out of Fremantle with a riot, which was led not just by the wharfies but by returned soldiers with guns and homemade giant tin bombs. Police, armed with bayonets, were driven off the streets of Fremantle with the premier at the time, a bloke called Hal Kalbach, also driven out. And, in fact, they closed down the police station in Fremantle for several months as a result. And they won a total victory, no more scabs. This is well known, but what I've discovered in my research is that the same thing happened in Melbourne, but in a more sort of in slow motion. I won't go into the details. It again involved violence, involved returned soldiers using some of the skills they've been taught by the bourgeoisie, and it also involved going on strike at the same time as the seamen and using that to help get rid of the scab bureau. Unfortunately, they didn't win back their wages, but that's another story. But the main point is that if you look at the groups who were involved, there's only one group that didn't recover in 1919, and that's the railway workers. And the reason was because they didn't fight in the first place, or at least not enough of them did. And this is an important distinction. Those workers who fought the hardest, and who stayed out the longest, they learned lessons from this strike. They came back within 12 months, ready to go again and to win. In the case of the seamen, they overturned decades of having conservative trade union officials and having a pretty weak industrial tradition. They began a tradition of politics and militancy which would last for the rest of the 20th century. A similar transformation happened on the waterfront. It's hard to imagine what we know about wharfies in the 20th century in Australia, but in 1917, the wharfies as a body resolved not to do anything to confront scabs. That was a mistake they would never make again. And I just want to finish with what I think encapsulates this. It's a quote from Tom Walsh. Oh, it doesn't matter. I know it off by heart. when he spoke at a mass meeting in the Socialist Hall in Exhibition Street in the beginning, early stages of the seamen's strike in 1919. And he told the assembled gathering, "It's the duty of all trade unionists to plunge this city into darkness." They did, and they won revenge. They'd learned their lessons from 1917. Yes, it was a defeat, but sometimes you learn from defeats. Sometimes defeats are as necessary as victories. As long as you fight, as long as you learn, do, try out stuff, test tactics, you can learn and come back stronger.